All right, folks, welcome to another edition of Civil Discourse. We are lucky enough to be joined by Spokane City's sitting council president and candidate for mayor, Ben Stuckert. As we have done for the past several episodes, I am going to ask Mr. Stuckert to explain or at least give us a brief outline on the three most important things to you as you face the world today. They don't have to be. I know you're running a political campaign right now. Those three things don't have to be political, though. So as you look at the world today and the landscape that we live in, what are the three most important things to you? I would like you to append that to your own intro. What do the people need to know about you? Kind of introduce yourself and then append those three things to the end of that.
All right. So I think the three most important things to me are my family, and I'll just kind of say them each, and then we can go in depth if you'd like.
Sure.
My family is the most important thing to me. I grew up in Spokane, and I really think we're a growing community. We've seen record amounts of growth, and so it's how do we grow smartly as a community, all of us together. So that's the second thing is growth, and how do we deal with that? And then I personally have a passion for the environment and how we treat our natural world, and that's really important to me.
All right. So is that two or three?
That's three. Family, how we grow, and the environment.
Okay, good
deal. And so I'll just talk about my family for a bit. I grew up in Spokane. My parents met as freshmen at Gonzaga University in 1967.
Go Zags.
My dad carried my mom's, carried her up into all her items up into her dorm room her freshman year. And I think she didn't talk to him for about 2 years after that. But they got married in 1971 on graduation day. I was born 5 months later.
Nice.
And, I've lived in Spokane for all but 6 years of my life. I went to Gonzaga too. I went to Lewis and Clark High School. I had the opportunity. I left for a couple of years and worked in the event ticketing industry. I worked at the Sydney Olympics. I worked for the Oakland Raiders. Then I had an opportunity to come back and work for Tickets West. And it was an opportunity to come back and be with my mom and dad.
Sure, sure.
My dad is one of the only people I know that only worked at one place his entire life. He worked at SNAP. It was formerly Spokane Neighborhood Action Programs.
Okay.
They started off as a program at Catholic Charities. And he actually did an internship there as a janitor when he was in college and then worked there starting in 1973 through when he retired. And unfortunately, he passed away in 2014, and that's had a profound impact on my life. And just last week, I spent Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday moving my mom from her four-bedroom house into a retirement home. And we did a lot of work on really trying to figure out where she could move from that house into a retirement home.
Sure.
And as we looked, my parents, my dad working for the same organization his whole life, my mom ended up being a kindergarten teacher and then a principal. We're fairly well set.
Oh, so she was an educator.
Yeah, she was an educator. She stayed home. She was a stay-at-home mom until my freshman year of high school, and then she went and worked as a substitute teacher at District 81, eventually became a kindergarten teacher for 8 years, and then eventually a principal.
Very, and, very, very noble profession.
So very noble.
Kudos to your mom.
But I guess we just spent the time moving her from her four-bedroom house into a retirement home. And so I've been doing a lot of research, and we haven't built, and I want to tie these back to city issues.
Sure, sure.
But we haven't built any affordable housing for our aging population. And we have a population, people are living longer.
Right.
People are choosing to retire in Spokane because we have such beautiful parks. We have such a beautiful river.
Right.
People are coming back that have moved away and bringing their families and then staying for the rest of their lives. So we have this aging population in Spokane that I don't think we're prepared for it. We're not prepared for it in workforce development where we have... In the trades, we have five people retiring for every one new apprenticeship that's coming in. That's whether that's the carpenters, whether that's the laborers, whether it's an electrical worker. But then we don't have enough housing over here. We aren't building. There hasn't been a single affordable unit for our elderly population built in the last 5 years. And so we have these struggles with these housing shortages where we have less than 2 months of supply in the city of housing. And then in multifamily units, we have a 1.4% vacancy rate. Now, vacancy rate of healthy a healthy vacancy rate is 5 to 6%. And the lower that vacancy rate goes, the more rents go up, the more people can't afford
it. Sure.
So I have a real estate client that her client who lives in a house, they're retired. They'd like to move and downsize, but there's nowhere they can afford to downsize to. And so that just came really clear to me. And so,
let me draw a distinction there. Is there none available or none affordable? And if it's affordable, what do you call affordable?
Well, it depends on how much money you have. You can dial it in and like, you have affordable housing that's built for somebody that has no income. You have affordable housing that's built for somebody that's at maybe making $25,000 a year, which is about 60% of the average median income. And then you have unaffordability for somebody that's making $45,000 a year, but it becomes unaffordable when you're spending about probably more than 35% of your income
sure.
on your mortgage or on your rent
sure.
every month.
And the only reason I ask that, because I think it's important for people to define that. I hear that term a lot. Affordable
right.
housing. Well, what the hell does that mean? It means a drastically different thing for different people.
Well, yeah, and it means drastically different for what is affordable in Seattle versus here, where their average median income is much, much higher than ours, or our
sure.
statewide average of average median income. We're on the low end, and ours has been going up. It's gone up about 15% over the last 7 years, but we're still not catching up to the state average median income in Spokane, and that's part of our, that's a real struggle for us if people can't afford housing and they can't afford to retire. And I look at my mom being left when my father died in 2014, and just how do you struggle with that? But I also tie family back to just all the things Spokane has to offer. It's such a place for families. It's such a, with the parks, we just renovated, and the citizens were grateful enough to vote for those refinancing of the bonds and put money sure. into Riverfront Park. And you need to be able to celebrate the center of our city.
Oh, absolutely. There's so many events. And, you know, I've talked about relocating on this podcast, and I want to loop back, so please don't let me forget it, to the trades, since you mentioned the trades, because Taylor, my wife, and I have devoted an entire podcast to trades and the value that a society places on a trade worker versus, you know, your college graduate, master's, bachelor degree holding person. And so that's interesting that you mentioned that. I'd certainly like to loop back to that.
Oh, absolutely.
If we have time. But my original thought was that, you know, people know I'm leaving. I love Spokane. I absolutely love this city. I love the geography of this city. There are some things that are driving my decision to leave here, though. And I hope we get to those, because one of the big issues for me is it seems that the homeless population here is taking a bigger percentage of the time of the job that you currently have of a city council president than the people you're talking about, like your mom, that are looking for affordable housing, that the people that are business owners here, the people that want to enjoy the park. I'm a photographer, amateur as I am, but I love to go out and take pictures. I won't do that downtown anymore.
Well, let's make sure we drive back to that.
Sure.
But on my next, I guess my next point was growth and how do we grow? And I'm going to loop this back. And when I talk about affordable housing, that's our, there's two things on the recent point in time count on homelessness. And the first biggest thing that people are homeless is because they don't have enough income. And I want to loop back to jobs, and that kind of goes to a conversation on trades, but it also goes back to some other issues we really need to work on.
Sure.
But on growth itself specifically, it's how do we grow? And what we're seeing on the West Coast is a surge in homeless populations. And whether that's San Diego, whether that's San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, we're seeing it in Boise. We're seeing it. I just visited Salt Lake City with the mayor because Utah was claiming they had solved chronic homelessness. And that's just, they have more shelter beds and more homeless count than Spokane does, and spend significant amounts more than we do on that issue. But we're just seeing this really come to a head right now. And so it's really a conversation about how do we grow. And we adopted a comprehensive plan in the early 2000s that the citizens said, this is our plan and this is how we want to grow. And the Growth Management Act that said, we don't want to spread out and we'd like to concentrate and have density in our cities.
Now, let me pause you, Rob. You said the citizens said with the growth management. Is that something that was enacted by the council or voted on by the citizens?
The citizens approved the comprehensive plan. It was all citizen driven. Now the Growth Management Act that was passed by the state, it exists. I don't think we'll ever see it go away.
Gotcha.
But we're under those constraints where we don't continually spread out. And I always use the example of Houston. Houston doesn't really have zoning and Houston doesn't have a Growth Management Act that says they can't spread out. So you know what they don't have? Is the housing crisis that I was talking about. But what they also have are problems when, say, you have a flood or you have a hurricane because you have no zoning, you have no protections, and it's much worse. But you have to think of things in terms of that. So what are you giving up if you have a Growth Management Act that says you can't go outward anymore? So that means our city had to adopt a comprehensive plan, and that was a citizen-led process. But that comprehensive plan, we've never fully adopted. And so it puts us.
Do me a favor, Ben. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No.
Pull that just a little closer.
Oh, closer.
But not in directly in front of you. That way we're getting.
How's that?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay. No, so our comprehensive plan says that we've adopted what's called a centers and corridors strategy, which means we have 27 different centers and corridors throughout the city that we want to be business centers. But the centers and corridors strategy only works if you have density around those centers and corridors. But so I like to use the clearest example is Monroe, where we just spent millions of dollars improving the street environment.
Sure.
A dozen new businesses have opened since we started the investment, which you can argue that's a good thing that you're revitalizing this business district. But unfortunately, if you go there, you have a business and then you have houses right next to the business district.
You're talking about Kendall Yards.
No. I'm talking right up in between Indiana and the bottom of the Garland Hill, the North Hill.
Okay.
That's the area where we spent about $8 million redoing all the pipes in the street, redoing the street environment. There's street trees. About a dozen new businesses have opened in that stretch since we invested the money, but it's surrounded by single family homes.
Right.
And business districts only survive if you have not just people driving to your business, but you have to have people walking to your business. And we've really missed out in Spokane in our centers and corridor strategy over the last 20 years in figuring out where the right place to have density is. And this goes back to my affordable housing conversation we were having a little bit earlier about our low vacancy rates.
Okay.
When you have low supply in capitalism and you don't have enough supply, prices rise.
Absolutely.
We are surrounding all of our centers and corridors with single family homes. And until we fix that problem, and that's a 10-20 year problem to rezone something, and then people have to buy that up and build that density. But there's...
I want to counterpoint that a little bit, because anybody who's listened to this podcast before knows that I was a cop. And single-family homes bring stability to an area. Multifamily dwellings, you're talking about apartments and condos, typically you're going to see an increase in crime. You're going to see an increase in property crime and domestic crime. Those are facts across the entire country. Multifamily housing brings issues to your city.
So I'm going to disagree with you and use two examples.
You can disagree all you want. Those are facts. Those are
No, I'm going to actually disagree with you and use facts from Spokane that show that density in areas around business districts don't increase crime. On Sprague Avenue, when we redid Sprague 3 years ago in the project I led, we actually put affordable housing down there and increased the density. And density has increased by about 25% down there in between the freeway and Sprague Avenue, and crime has fallen by 30%. So
where I just want to kind of visualize the demographic you're talking about.
It's in between Hamilton and Altamont. We spent about $18 million revitalizing that neighborhood. We've had 24 new businesses open.
Sure.
In between.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a beautiful area.
Right. And that was my project.
Businesses are, I've only been in Spokane since 2011. when I first drove that area, it was like a flipping wasteland.
Correct.
Now I see businesses that I might want to visit and not worry about my car getting vandalized.
But we also densified it at the same time we spent infrastructure dollars in that area, and it did improve crime.
So when you say you densified it, spell that out for me so I know
we,
what...
We changed the density requirements to allow more than just the single family homes. And we also incentivized affordable housing to be built down there.
But you said incentivized it, but does that mean multifamily units are there?
Yes, there's two new multifamily affordable housing unit projects that have opened since 2011 down there, since we started our project.
Okay, and I certainly hope you don't see this as a jousting match, because I don't want to point for point you, but I do want to explain terms. When you say you densified it, please, you know, just for edification of someone who might not know what that means, explain that. Or multifamily units, and it just so someone who isn't smart in those terms can understand it.
Right. And so that's what I was talking about in Monroe. You're surrounded by single family homes, and you need to rezone that area, because in order for the business district to survive, and this is what we did right on Sprague, is the zoning changed from single family to multifamily zoning.
Now, you said affordable housing.
And we also gave incentives on affordable housing on Sprague.
So what do you qualify as? And so that's my vagary that I really want to clear up, because we've used that terms a few times, and we've said affordable housing is dependent on the person that is living there. So when you say you had a requirement for affordable housing, two units there, what do you mean?
We give incentives to people that built affordable housing there.
Okay,
and but those are they use federal dollars, home dollars are some of the dollars, the state housing trust fund. So those are subsidized housing. And so that means people can use housing vouchers there, or they have to qualify and their median household income has to be 60% or below.
So it's a HUD.
Yes.
Okay.
That's one way of describing it. It's not necessarily HUD housing, because there's other agencies that build affordable housing.
Right.
But if that's a commonality of...
Well, for me, someone who's not daily in the political arena, I'm a citizen, you know, I don't understand the term that you're using. When you say affordable housing, I had Chris Schroll on here. I don't know if you listen to his podcast.
Mm-mm.
He used a lot of those just really buzzwords, and that kind of are clickbaity, you know, people in that sector that you're trying to appeal to are going to like that when you use those words. For me, I want to explain them. I want to kind of expand them and let people know who might listen to this, what that actually means. And
yeah, I guess to me, affordable housing has a lot more meaning, and the people that I'm out in the community talking to understand affordable housing more than HUD housing.
Right on. Okay.
So, but in the Sprague area,
mm-hmm.
we changed the zoning. So from single family zoning to allow multifamily zoning, so you have more density. And we also incentivized that if agencies were using dollars from the federal government or the state government that passed through, we said, okay, we'll give you extra points if you build in that area.
What does that mean? Extra points.
You score when you turn in an application. Those applications are reviewed by a committee and they give them points. And so if they were located in the Sprague area, they got extra points. And so we have two projects down there. So you have a mixed income neighborhood, because not only did two projects located there, but we also have raised the median household income because jobs have been created. And so you can do both things. You can create density and a safer environment and raise the overall average of the average income of the citizen. And so what I'm saying is that was successful on Sprague. And so we need to look at that on Monroe, because Monroe, after we spend all this money improving the road, if it's still surrounded with single family homes and you don't have the people walking to those small local businesses, and what'll happen is what's happened in I don't know if you're familiar with the Perry Street neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
So Perry Street, 20 years ago when I was in high school and we used to go running when I was on the cross country team, You couldn't run through Grant Park by yourself. You had to be with a buddy on the cross-country team. And now it's a thriving area. Over the last 20 years, it's seen the highest property values increases inside the city over that 20-year period. And it was all because some investments were made in infrastructure. But where they, what we've seen is a plateau where all these new businesses opened. But then for the last 2 years, we've had empty buildings. There's a huge new development that built on the corner of 9th and Perry, and it's been open for, that building's been finished for a year, but it's not full. And part of the problem is there's not enough people walking to that district. Everybody drives to that point.
Sure.
So you create, so in that instance, it helps the business district if you have more density near it.
Oh, I can absolutely understand that. So
our growth, to go back to the important question is how are we going to grow?
Sure.
And so we need more land and more apartments too, if we want to affect a vacancy rate of 1.4%.
Land is finite, Ben. You can't grow more than that.
No, but you can change it from single family to multifamily.
I'm just being an asshole right now. I'm sorry.
The other thing we can do is how we grow is if downtown Spokane, you look at downtown Spokane and we have 76 lots that are surface parking lots. What you should probably have, if our economy was completely churning at the right point,
I'm going to beat you up as soon as you finish this. Please go ahead.
You would have 6 or 7 covered parking garages around downtown, just like Pasadena, California did. And then those surface parking lots wouldn't be necessary, and you would build up on those and have more people living downtown. You should probably have about 5,000 people living in downtown Spokane in order to make it safer and healthier for everybody and support all of the different activities we want people in the urban center for.
So my beautiful wife, the one thing that she wanted me to discuss with the president of the council, the city of Spokane, is parking downtown. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wasn't going to bring it up unless it came up. She works downtown, you know, and downtown is a very vital piece of the economy of Spokane, right? Because people come there. People come there to shop. People come there to visit, to see the beautiful sights. And parking is an issue. Well, so the council put in these meters, and you folks did these. There's several spots where it's just ridiculous to park, where if I want to come down for an event, if I want to come down to enjoy if I want to shop, if I want to go to a movie, I'm limited to 2 hours, and I can't use my phone, my smart device, which thank God the meters are now smart, but I can't use my smart device to say I want another 2 hours. I got to physically walk my ass out there, move my car. Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't. But what you need is alternatives, which would be a system of covered lots that are safer than the surface lots, so that if you wanted to park long term, but those are all full.
You know what, Ben? I'm going to wholeheartedly disagree with you, because when you guys enacted, and I'm sorry, I'm pointing at you saying you guys, when you did that, when the council did that, those lots, I'm sure you know this, they increase their prices because they know there's no other alternative. If I want to go downtown and enjoy downtown Spokane, I'm going to have to pay $15 at a lot, because I can't park for less than 2 hours or for more than 2 hours at many of these spots.
I believe we're agreeing, but you don't think we are, because those are private lots run by these corporations that have no vested interest. We've gone in, the mayor and I have gone and met with the CEOs. They don't want to build up on those lots. The way to get them to build up on the lots is to have a public-private partnership and the covered lots, and you could put them out of business by underpricing them immediately, and so they would build up on those private lots, and you would have covered, safer lots.
What does that mean? I mean, do they own those lots?
Those lots, yes.
So that's private property. How do you make them want to do that?
When it becomes economical for them to build up, they will, and they'll admit that. But right now, they own all these surface lots around our town, and there's no disincentive for them to do it. or if you're
I've been in the ticketed down there. Okay, so
if you're in the center of our city, right across from the Rid Path, it used to be an old historic block, and they knocked it down, and a family owns it. It's the Rue family. There's five of them, and basically they view that as their retirement, and they either draw money from the Diamond, who leases their lot, and they get a check, or they want $5 million, which is way too expensive for that one lot. It's probably worth 3.5 right now, but they won't go any lower than 5 in order to build up on it. But you have that situation all over town. And if we had 4 or 5 lots that were covered and built up and safer, we lost E-Tails, moved out to Liberty Lake because their employees didn't want to park in those surface lots because they didn't feel they were safe. And I don't blame them. At 4:30 when it gets dark in the winter, if you're a recent college graduate, one of those lots with no lights on isn't where you're going to park. You're going to want a lighted, covered facility. And you can put those lots out of business by underpricing them if you had the multi-story lots.
Okay.
And then I agree with you. You definitely need to be able to fix.
And so I will tell you my initial reaction to you saying that covered lots are the answer negates your security plus on that. Because if you have a covered lot, where do your homeless are going to go? They're going to go to your covered lot. Why? Because they're out of the elements. Ben.
I've never
we are going to disagree with this on this one point, and I'm completely fine to just disagree with this. However, there are a lot of people that agree with me that listen to this that want to hear from you as to the challenge of homelessness and the crime that it creates, the trash that it creates. I just saw an ad on Facebook of all places, and I shriek at mentioning a Facebook thing, but I saw one 2 days ago that says there is a day where we're asking you to come down and clean help us clean up downtown Spokane.
Clean right? From the core.
Sure, right? How long would that last? Let's say every citizen in Spokane donated their time to come and clean up downtown. How long do you actually think it would last?
How long would it stay clean, or how long does it take to clean?
How long do you think it would stay clean?
I'm not sure of the answer to that question.
Come on, Ben.
You know, you just said that we shouldn't build covered parking lots in a discussion about how to solve parking, and then said if we built covered parking lots, the homeless would be there. We have four very large covered parking lots in downtown that don't have that problem.
Why? Why don't they have that problem?
Because they don't have the problem you're saying would happen if we had other covered lots.
Because they have security there that would kick them out.
Right, which you would have on the other lots too.
As a photographer, I can't go in that lot and take pictures. I've been kicked out of that lot right in downtown Spokane trying to take pictures of...
So what would be different about other lots that would solve our parking problem?
Because now you're asking a private entity to enact security to kick homeless out, which our council has just recently voted on something that said our homeless can be anywhere.
No, in a
public space.
No, that's absolutely not true. We have strong anti-camping laws, and that's why you don't see the things that you see in Seattle.
Oh my goodness.
We just passed that last year. We strengthened the anti-camping laws. We actually strengthened them on public lands.
Are they enforced?
Yes, they're enforced. I just got an email this afternoon about some camps down by the river that were being removed.
Ben, it's the reason I don't go downtown anymore, my friend.
Yeah.
It's seriously.
Yeah, you don't want to talk about solutions. I'm talking about density. How do we get more housing?
I do.
How do we get more housing? That's what people are homeless because they don't have houses. I'm talking about solutions on the parking problem that you brought up. And your answer to covered parking was that the homeless would be there. And they're not in the current covered parking.
Hold on one second. You're feeling attacked. I don't want you to feel attacked. Are they under every single one of our bridges downtown?
No, they aren't, because we enforce the sit and lie law. You could drive by Brown just like I did 15 minutes ago, and there's nobody under the Brown Viaduct. The only reason that it wasn't being enforced last fall was because it was unconstitutional. The Ninth Circuit has said if you don't have enough shelter beds available, it's unconstitutional, cruel and unusual punishment to enforce anti-camping laws and the sit and lie law, which is why we have to have warming centers and shelters for the immediate solution. You have to have shelter. If you don't have the shelter space, they would be camping everybody. Since you brought up
the Ninth Circuit, it just happens to be the most overturned circuit in the country.
This one was just upheld. The Boise ruling was just upheld.
By the Supreme Court? U.S. Yep. Supreme Court?
They have not chosen to review that because I don't know if they agree or disagree, but that one hasn't gone up to the Supreme Court.
Well, when you say upheld,
Boise appealed it on like seven different reasons.
To the Ninth Circuit.
Right. And that hasn't gone to the Supreme Court, but it's enforceable action.
Right. But because of a Ninth Circuit ruling, which happens to be the most overturned circuit in our entire country.
Which is irrelevant to enforcement of the law. If we enforce the sit and lie law, or we enforce the anti-camping ordinance when there's not enough shelter beds available, we're violating the Constitution.
Okay,
so that's like the mayor agrees with that. Everybody that's read the rulings agrees with that.
So that's a good point. So why do we? Let's talk about that then for a minute. I don't want you to come here and feel like you're being attacked. And if you do, at the end of this, I'll never air it. That's my promise to you. I want to talk about solutions. I don't want you to think that I don't want to talk about solutions. We may not agree on the on the solution, but civil discourse. I don't think we have to agree to be able to communicate about our community.
Right, but I worry when you say things like council is allowing people to be anywhere on public lands when that's actually the opposite of what we've done. Now, we have one council member that brought up some homeless bill of rights that said that, and everybody in the media was very loud on council that that's dead on arrival.
Okay.
But it did get play in the media, which makes it sound like we did pass that, but that's absolutely not true. Councilmember Kinnear last year took the current anti-camping law that was in place and strengthened it in order to protect our park system. Nobody that I know wants Riverfront Park, this beautiful park, to become a campground. Nobody wants, when I go to Seattle and I go down to Pike Place Market and I walk down to the piers, and there must have been 200 people camping under the old viaduct.
Right.
Nobody wants that in Spokane. That's not what I'm about. That's not why I'm running for mayor.
I hope not.
And if there's a perception out there that that's where we're all at, that's just absolutely not true. We do have to provide shelter beds, immediate shelter beds at night for people to sleep in. That's humane. But it's also, we can't enforce the anti-camping ordinance or sit and lie, and things will be bad under the bridge.
So can I ask you, just again, for clarification for someone who's completely not in tune with that, you said you have to provide shelter beds. Where does that requirement come from?
That's the Ninth Circuit ruling. They ruled Boise's sit and lie law and Boise anti-camping ordinance unconstitutional because they were enforcing it when there was nowhere else for them to go sleep. They said if they you can't tell them they can't sleep on the sidewalk if there's not a bed for them to go to. They don't have to go use that bed, of course, but if that bed's available and it's a low barrier, which is why we opened up 245 beds this winter in warming centers so that those laws could be enforced and we wouldn't have people outdoors. It's not safe for people to be outdoors. We can agree on 100% on that. People prey on them. Also, at City Hall, when the shelters weren't open and they were camping outside my workplace every day.
Sure.
I was talking to the homeless outreach team at SNAP, and I've known the gentleman, Bob Peeler, for 30 years. And Bob said, watch. He goes, they'll try to self-organize for a few days. And after 7 days, what's going to happen is you'll start to see things change. And I'm totally honest. Within 7 days, I saw a pimp come and try to get people out of their tents. I saw drug dealers, and the number of needles outside of City Hall proliferated. That's not a safe environment for anybody, and it's not humane. Like
Ben, you just described what business owners are dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. The problem has gotten worse.
I have a friend, and I'm not going to name him by name because he would not appreciate that. He is a business owner and owns a law firm downtown. Well, not owns it. He is a principal partner in it. Next to his law firm, he's dealing with exactly what you just talked about. Needles, trash, shit, human feces in his parking lot. And this law firm is probably one of the biggest grossing entities in downtown Spokane. Personal friend of mine. And he has to hire private security and private janitorial services to go out there and clean his parking lot. And so, although I'm very twisted on this issue because fiscally, I'm very conservative. I would like to believe that socially, I'm very liberal. I want people to be able to do what they want to do without a lot of government interference. But one of the things you just said is that you're required to provide them beds. My conservative fiscal side says, what the hell is up with that? Why are we as a society required to provide person X or person Y a bed?
And that's a fair question. I'm not going to get into, I don't understand the legality of the Ninth Circuit ruling. I read part of it, and the argument is that it's cruel and unusual punishment to
punishment
to take somebody to jail and cite them where they could end up in jail if there's a bed, not a bed available for them to go to. Now, up until 5 years ago, the city wasn't involved in funding our shelter system at all. That was all privately funded and federally funded. The feds have moved to a system where they don't fund shelters. And so that has fallen on local governments in order to try to figure it out. Now, my question back to you is and this is when I have this, I switch on my opinion.
Sure.
And so you talked about.
I apologize to anybody who's hearing my dogs
How can we hear that so great? They're just, they're in the other room and the door's closed.
They're big dogs.
Yeah, they are big dogs.
Okay. So
as a human, I just want to ask you this question because I flip back and forth on this one, and that's the human waste. So say somebody's on the street, they're homeless and they're not breaking any laws. Let's say they're not using drugs openly. They're not doing anything, but they have to use a restroom and there's no restroom available. And so my question is, and that's awful. I've stepped in human waste before.
Yeah.
And in situations where the camps are bad and it's just awful. But the question is do you provide some restrooms for them so that that doesn't happen? And I've heard the argument, I've heard all sorts of arguments on that, that that's encouraging them to be outside or downtown, but also it's a humane thing to do. It solves a problem. And so I flip back and forth on that one. And I flip back and forth over the last 7 years as I've seen this problem get worse.
This is my opinion. This is my opinion and my opinion alone. I completely flip back and forth with you on that. So I would say that if that person doesn't have a place to go to the bathroom to relieve him or herself, that's an issue. How are you going to cite him or her, and how are you going to haul them off to jail for public indecency? Because that's really what you're talking about, right? And the common citizen who doesn't understand the laws behind that, that's exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about incarcerating them for a criminal misdemeanor, a criminal act, when they had nowhere else. If businesses don't allow them to go in, or if the city doesn't allow them to utilize public facilities. The second half of me says, why are you homeless?
Yeah, why aren't you one of the shelters?
Because, you know, I'm a 48-year-old man. And from the time that I was 17 years old, I made my own way in this world. And no one handed it to me. My parents weren't rich. I came from a very lower middle class family. I joined the military, and granted, that's not for everybody. However, you know, I saw a path. I knew I wanted to do that from the time that I was a young man. And, you know, I have provided for myself, my family, and, you know, my spouse. We have a nice home in which I have many bathrooms that I can relieve myself. So I do see the dichotomy there. I do see the enormous disparity in our population, and the humanitarian side of me says that is a horrible option for someone to have to face. Do I urinate on the street, on the side of a building, in front of people who might be walking by and viewing it? What's the only other alternative? Do I urinate in my pants? Well, that's not an acceptable option either. But, you know, fiscally, you know, and that's really where I wrestle, is the fiscal kind of conservative mindset that I have, that I want my tax dollars to be put to the greatest use, because they're finite, right? They are, that is a finite percentage that you draw from every income earning citizen. And do I want those to be put to good use? Of course I do. But do I want to completely say, F that person, they're not worth my dollars? No. And I really think that's where difficult decisions, difficult discussions need to be made in a public forum, where people don't necessarily agree with one another, that actually have the mental processes to sit down and talk with someone who doesn't agree with them and compromise. That word, if anything, is the most important word in my life. Compromise is probably up there in the top 5% of words that I use on a daily basis. And I think our society, our politics, definitely need to get back to
compromise.
Yes. Compromise. We don't always have to win.
Correct. And it's much better when you have both extremes that are mad at you and the center is happy with you than just one extreme or one extreme happy with you. Much better policy gets made that way. So can we continue down this road on homelessness? And the number one reason that we get is lack of income. And so some people end up at the bottom end of end of the parabola in our economic system.
Sure.
And so how do we, I always talk about, you know, we have some units being built of affordable housing for the chronically homeless. So those that are making 30% of average median household income, but we're not seeing the working poor, the person that's only working 30 hours a week at a minimum wage job.
That's now you're speaking my language, because you're talking about someone trying to survive.
Right.
Somebody, and I can agree on this point. How do I help that guy?
Yeah. And that's the area in our community right now where housing that fits in, because if you're working 30 hours a week at $13 an hour and you're trying to support a child,
sure,
rent is rising because we've got such a slack. You would qualify for a housing voucher from HUD. And that housing voucher acts like cash, but there's nothing available for them. So there's 800 people got housing vouchers in 2018 that couldn't find housing. So our key is not just going to be create more housing stock at all levels, whether that's houses or apartments, so that you take the crunch off, but it's also going to be, how do we create some housing for those people that are struggling to get by, whether that's our aging population, somebody that's retired and they don't have a pension anymore. They don't have a real good 401k. Maybe all they have is Social Security. So all they've got is Social Security to live on. There's no housing being built for that population. There's no housing being built for the working poor. And we've got to figure out, and the federal government, the money, if you compared the money we used to get for building that type of housing, in 1992, the city got $1.5 million of home dollars. So that would build these houses.
Sure.
Last year, we got $1.2 million in home dollars. But if you took that
what does that mean? What does home dollars mean?
And it's I don't know what the acronym is.
Why does the Fed kick in on home dollars?
The federal government decided back in the 60s that they would give every community, based on your population and what your income levels were from your census data, they would give you a certain amount of dollars to build affordable housing.
Kind of like schools.
Yeah.
All right. So you're funded based on your population. Yeah, food
stamps is a federal program where they give you that into your community. And so they used to give local governments, but in 1992, it was $1.5 million. And if you took inflation into account, that would be about 2.9 million right now.
Okay.
But we got 1.2 last year. So it hasn't kept up. And so we're not building as much. And in the last few years, we haven't built any affordable housing for the working poor or for our aging population. So when their rents rise, because everything's so constricted, they're the people that end up on the streets. And we've got to fix that part of the problem. That nut has to be cracked somehow locally.
But I am hoping that the person you're talking about right now isn't the same person that's leaving hypodermic needles on our street.
No, but I'm working with a gentleman right now that I met at one of the shelters this winter, and he's on the replacement drug for heroin. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's methadone.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of methadone.
He keeps going back between methadone and heroin, and he's having a real struggle, but he'd like to get into treatment. So I've been trying to call around and get him into treatment, and he even has some state insurance, but the wait is 6 months. And so we had a gentleman downtown last week, a video was sent to me of a gentleman standing outside the Starbucks, and he looked around and then he pulled a needle out of his pocket and shot up. And so I sent it to the police chief and to our downtown precinct captain. And I said, you know, Lieutenant Singley and Chief Meidel, what's going on here? They knew who he was. He'd been released from jail. He'd been 90 days in jail. When he got arrested the last time, he asked to go to treatment. He wanted to get better, and no treatment was available for him, so they threw him in the county jail. He left and went right back out on the drugs.
Hold on one second. Hold on.
How do we deal with that?
I don't like the line you just drew. No treatment was available, so they threw him in the jail.
Well, I think you can have judges can give an alternative,
but there has to be a reason to incarcerate someone. It isn't because no treatment is available.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was robbing somewhere to get his drugs or what. Oh,
okay, so that's why he was thrown in jail. It's not because there wasn't treatment available.
No, but he wanted to get in treatment, and they actually will, if somebody can get better through that and stop their criminal behavior, it's better to get them out of treatment and clean and a productive member of society than to continually just churn people through the jail system, especially when as crowded as it is.
Well, you know what, Ben? I would love to believe that's the case. However, having been a street cop, I will tell you that a lot of people have come into Jesus moments once handcuffs are placed on them.
Oh, I agree.
So for someone to espouse that they want to clean up their life when they're sitting in the back of a fucking squad car is a lot different than someone to come to the council or come to a treatment center when there are no stakes on the table and say, look, I need help. Is there help available? Because there are plenty of, especially in Spokane, there are plenty of organizations that are willing to say, absolutely, we will help you. To me, it's disingenuous once you're in the back of a squad car with handcuffs on to say, I need help.
Well, for the gentleman that I have been working with and trying to find an inpatient treatment center that has insurance, I'd love to know where those beds are available, because we are having a hard time, both our police officers and the Downtown Spokane Partnership would love to partner up with anybody that has great answers on treatment. Because it's a huge issue.
It is. However, is it an issue for society? Because that decision, and so we'll probably differ greatly on this one too. I'm not a drug addict. Do you know why I'm not a drug addict? Because I never made the decision to poke a needle into my vein. I don't think it's a societal problem to fix.
I think when the opioid manufacturers shipped 2 billion pills to our state and illegally prescribed them, I think that is a problem. And I think it creates a drug crisis. And I think they can also be held accountable and not just individuals.
Oh, you and I are absolutely in agreement there. I have had a standing prescription for, and like I said, and many people know that I'm a veteran of 22 years. With 4 combat tours under my belt, I have a standing prescription for one of the most potent narcotics on the planet. I don't abuse them though. Right? So that's a personal choice.
Now, I think some people's brains are wired differently and they get addicted easier than you.
Well,
I think that
and, I, I'm... And so, there, and I don't know if you've ever had any personal experience, I'm not going to ask you, but there is a certain feeling that you get, you know, it is a rush. It's kind of like a high that when you take this thing, you get, and if you seek that, if you chase that, you're going to get addicted. But I'm smart enough to know that the danger of that Oxycontin or that whatever you're on or whatever you're prescribed, if you abuse that, it is a gateway. A legal prescription can be a gateway to a lifelong addiction.
Well, heroin's cheaper, so people get addicted to opioids.
Sure.
And then go chase that high because sure. They're addicted to that, can't get the opioids anymore.
Sure.
And then turn to things like heroin.
At one point, it was a choice.
Some people have much higher addictive personalities than others. And when the drug manufacturers are working with pharmacists, when you have 2 billion of those pills shipped in, I think
that's a problem. And people should be going to prison for that.
Shared responsibility.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And you're not going to get any disagreement with me that people who are over prescribing as a profit motive, whether you're the person actually prescribing it or the person dealing it out or the person shipping it, we have a huge problem within our federal system that allows that to happen.
Yeah, and we agree completely.
Yeah.
So on the other end of, if we don't want to just talk about shelters and housing, to me, a lot of it's about opportunity and how do we provide more opportunities for people. And to me, that goes back to what we did on Sprague, where the new small businesses have opened and given people opportunities to open businesses and then people to work there. Or on Monroe, it's how does the city smartly spend money. I don't know if you saw the announcement today, though, out on the West Plains with Mullen Technologies.
I didn't. Please explain.
Yeah, so we created a public, starting in 2015, Councilman Mike Allen and I started working on with the Larry Crowder, the CEO of the airport, and Commissioner French in the county on how are we all going to partner on the West Plains on creating economic development. So we worked for 2 years to create a
public. So when you say West Plains, you're talking west of where?
Well, the West Plains, it can be largely encompassing, which is why we're working on changing the name.
It's the area around the airport. It's one of those things that I'm just trying to get clarification on.
So if we look at what this defined public development authority on the West Plains is where the waste energy plant, where we burn our garbage.
Sure.
West of there, east of Fairchild Air Force Base,
okay,
north of I-90, and south of Highway 2. That's the box. That's the geographic box.
That's not a very big box.
No, but it includes city and county land.
Sure.
And most of it's vacant, and it's all zoned for industrial, and so it's where Amazon landed and built their big million square. The PDA was integral in closing that deal. It's the first time the city and the county have ever agreed to share profit. So taxes that come in from projects inside those boundaries, 75% of those then get poured back into infrastructure in that area. So when Amazon came and said, well, we'll locate our facility here, but we need you guys to run your water lines, run your sewer lines. We need you to build a new road along the freeway, Geiger Boulevard. We need you to work with the federal government, and the state government on those interchanges. The city and the county and the airport were able to act in lockstep, go to the feds, get a grant.
Sure.
We were able to put money from the tax revenue from the building of the building, all the construction sales tax, back into the project. And so it closed the deal.
Right.
So today, Mullen Technologies, which is an electric car manufacturer, just announced the intent to sign a deal with the West Plains PDA, and that was announced today. And it's going to start off in 2019 with 50 jobs, and the average wage there is going to be $90,000. A lot of good engineering jobs. And then eventually, the components are all going to be shipped from manufacturing China to the Port of Tacoma, sent over here. The cars are going to be put together here. That'll be just the car putting together factory will be 860 new jobs by 2025. And then they're doing testing on lithium batteries for these cars. And if they put their production facility here, which they were really positive about in the last couple of conversations we had, that'd be 3,000 jobs total. That's what we need to be. If we're working on long-term solutions, and what are our long-term solutions? It's how do we strengthen our small local businesses?
Is that
and how do we attract good? No, I'm talking the business centers.
That's massive.
I was thinking Monroe and Sprague. I keep going back to that because those areas are good success stories, but we need to replicate throughout Spokane. But then we need to be attracting these good jobs that are going to help everybody in our community by raising the median household income.
So I'm extremely excited to hear about that. That's super positive news. And so one question coming into my mind, because I'm really trying to envision myself as someone who does not follow local politics, state politics, federal politics on a daily basis, and really wants to know Ben, right? Because that's why you're here. I hope that's why you're here. You want that citizen out there to get to know you a little bit better. How long have you been doing this? How long have you been representing and working for Spokaneites interests? Can you kind of roll through your background as in your endeavors to help, whether it be an elected official or not?
So I came back to, I was gone from Spokane after I graduated college.
Sure.
From 95 to 2001. I came back and ran a three-state region for Tickets West, which handles all the local ticketing. I ran our Montana region. I ran Idaho and Washington State. We had offices around the whole region.
You got any hookups there that can get me with a couple of cool concerts before I leave?
Everybody I knew was left. I left in 2007.
That's a completely bullshit question. I'm sorry I asked it.
No, but I did. I was really proud because, you know, it was in the for-profit industry. And I grew the revenue from $13 million to $26 million while I was there.
Nice.
And really tried to grow our expanse of where our business was. But then I had a calling. I went to graduate school and got my master's at Gonzaga.
In what?
Organizational leadership.
Right on. That's, you know what? For someone, that degree that you just talked about is the one that I tell people when they say they're going to do a liberal arts, and I'm going to kind of bash on liberal arts there because there's a lot of unemployed liberal arts graduates out there. That more than anything is what I tell people to go for. If you want to be an instrument of change in your local neighborhood, in your state, in your federal government, that is a good one to have. Depending on where you get it, Gonzaga is a beautiful place to get it. You get exposed to a lot of a macro view versus a micro view of the society that we live in.
Absolutely. And it changed my framework. So I went and ran a nonprofit for 4 years called Communities in Schools, trying to get resources and connected to kids in school that were at risk. Because as earlier we start with people, the less likely they're to end up in our streets.
Mm-hmm.
And it was impactful, but I didn't feel like, and so they gave me $25,000 and said, I had a really good board of directors though, with members from Costco and Comcast were really supportive.
Sure.
But there was $25,000 in the bank. And at the end of 4 years when I left, we had 10 employees and it started with just me, and we had a $500,000 annual budget. And so I kind of figured out how to grow that, got it on a stable path. And then I ran for city council president, and I've been there for 7.5 years. Now I have found the things I get most passionate about are the growth issues that I talked about with density.
Sure.
Because that's a long-term look at our city, I think, and it does solve a lot of different problems. And you have to do it right. You can't just throw density everywhere. You can't just throw apartments everywhere. I agree with you there. There's the right places and the wrong places. And that's why our comprehensive plan calls that out. But I also get really excited about the economic development world. And it's really hard in these polarized times.
Absolutely.
And we all should be celebrating the fact that Sprague is a great project that we've small business owners have opened there.
Absolutely.
Or Monroe.
And you know what, though? Even beyond that, it's a place that you can drive down and feel just an emotional reaction to it, because it looks pleasant to the eye. And when you're talking about someone who may want to come and live there, they're not scared.
Right.
It's somewhere that is visually stimulating, because you have development, you have growth, and
right.
you're not looking at, you know, run down dilapidated buildings with, you know, windows broken out. You know, there's a long-standing police theory.
Oh, broken windows broken theory. Windows,
yeah.
I love it. And that's Monroe is the same thing. And then like what happened today, and we were able to announce Mullen Technologies, I spend a lot of time on these public development authorities and how are we going to do economic development? And that's, I'm running for mayor because I think those are the long-term solutions. And I totally hear all you're saying about downtown. I do hear you. I understand people's concerns. I just think when we just talk about that immediate problem, sometimes we lose these larger long-term solutions. Because if we have a better economy for everybody and there's more opportunities, then you're going to have less people on the streets. If we're going to have...
See, I see desire as a big... is something that no politician can solve.
Yes.
Desire.
Yeah, and that's why I guess I would never sit here and tell you we're going to solve homelessness. I'm not that guy. I've seen you know, stacks on my desk sure. about what other cities have done.
Sure.
But the best is, I think it's at Benton County in New Jersey, and much smaller city, much smaller population of homeless, but my brother-in-law lives there. They'd seen it grow. And so they brought in, a former sergeant from the military and said, deal with this like it's a battle. And she, very structured, very organized, started getting people out there, meeting with the people that were on the streets, and took care of the problem. Now, the problem was much more manageable than the 1,300 people that are homeless by our homeless count. But there are communities that have put the resources into it immediately so that they save the resources down here in the long term. Because the number, somebody called me today, and I haven't verified this, but they said it's about... in emergency services for police to be called, fire to be called on medical, and we're totally way over my time. And I told my wife I'd be home, but
you're in trouble because we just got started.
we got to close this down. And hospital stays, it's about $80,000 a year. So we got to figure out how to deal with it. I hear all your concerns. I just think we're in a good place as a city. There's just some opportunities that we have to work a lot harder at. And that's why I'm running for mayor.
You want to wrap this up, Ben?
I do.
Okay, so we are at an hour and 2 minutes. I'm going to invite you back because I think there's a lot of stuff that we didn't even break the surface on.
Oh, I could go on and on. And but an hour is good for me, or I start to ramble.
I hope that you have seen this as something beneficial. You know?
Oh, no, we really got it. I think there was one minor bump in the road, which happens when people haven't communicated before.
Sure.
But I thought we worked through it really well and in a civil way, didn't we?
I would certainly hope so. And anybody that's listening to this, I hope that they would view what you're saying, maybe get a little bit better insight as to who you are, your experience, and where you want to go with the city, and maybe look forward to the next one, because... I think you're a very intelligent guy. You obviously have a lot of experience in running city government, and I'd like to talk to you again.
Yeah, and we didn't even really touch on some of the police and fire issues. We didn't touch on streets. We didn't touch on Riverfront Park.
We didn't loop back into trades either.
Yeah, trades and yeah.
Can we schedule another one?
Yeah, we will.
All right.
Promise. Ben,
anything you want to close out with?
No, I appreciate you having me on, and I really enjoyed it.
All right, man. I will share this with you so you can get it out to people that want to support Ben Stuckert for mayor.
All right, appreciate it.
This has been Ben. Thank you for tuning in.